Hello, and welcome to the 7th Bad Idea Podcast, starring myself, Steve Carlson.
And Simon Abrams.
You are disgusting!
You love it.
I do. Today, the theme, as suggested by Mr. Abrams.
Hello!
Suggested by his recent trip to the Toronto Film Festival.
Hello!
Because he's awesome like that. Is films that have played the Toronto Film Festival that are, shall we say, of a lesser caliber.
Yes, these are all films in today's podcast we're discussing that have a heinous reputation. We were actually considering doing Undead because that's another horrible film, but that's the kind of film we're talking about. Films that have reputations that precede them that are so awful that they're just widely considered to be the bottom of the barrel. Not just like, oh, people walked out bad, but like people walked out like screaming bad.
The kind of films where if you happen to be at a major film fest, you walk out going, what the hell is that doing here?
Right. Exactly. That's the key difference between that and, say, Faust this year, which Alexander Sokurov did and had in, like, a theater that sat, like, about 220 people. There were about 80 people that walked out of my theater, which is pretty substantial. But still, you would never... That movie before that won the Golden Lion at Venice. So that's not the kind of film that we're talking about here.
Or similarly, I've only been once in 2007, but... One of the last films I saw before I left was Michelangelo Quay's Eat, for This Is My Body.
Okay.
And I'd say there were probably 60 people in the auditorium. Not a popular ticket, but by the time the credits rolled, there were maybe 20.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Eat from This Is My Body actually went on to New Director's new film, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it did.
So that's the difference between...
And I think it's a pretty good film, but...
There you go.
That's neither here nor there.
One of the 20 people has spoken.
Woo!
But yeah, the films that we talked about are much more disreputable.
Yeah.
And let's start with, because we just watched it, Shadowboxer.
No. I think we should end on that one.
We should end on Shadowboxer
because that's how amazing it is. No, I was.
Let's
I was,
talk about.
I was saying. I was thinking.
Devil's
we
Chair?
Should, no, I was thinking we should first get into Jennifer's Body.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, there's some. Anyway, okay, fine.
Or if you want to do The Devil's Chair first, that's fine. But either way, we're starting with a Midnight Madness title.
All right. Yeah, Colin Geddes. It's no surprise his Midnight Madness program has been the home of numerous disreputable and just flat out awful films. We were actually tempted at one point to do The Bunker. Which I've heard stories of people saying that they were going to go see The Bunker, and they told Colin, he's like, oh, I'm sorry.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Ouch. Why would you program a film that you actively don't want people to see?
That's a good question. I think, you know, you'd have to ask Colin that. But the fact of the matter is, Jennifer's Body was a Midnight Madness film.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly, you can see why he might program such a film sight unseen because, you know, it'll get
butts in seats. You got the Diablo Cody factor.
Yeah, and you got the fact that it's not a small budget film.
Yeah. Megan Fox is a draw, and, you know.
J.K. Simmons, even though no one goes to see Jennifer's Body for J.K. Simmons.
This was the second time I've seen it, I have to admit, and I totally forgot that J.K. Simmons was in it.
I started to watch Jennifer's Body one time, and I stopped watching it, but, like, the one thing I was like, well, at least J.K. Simmons is in it. So
yeah,
that was, like, the one thing I remember about it.
I didn't even remember that, so.
But, yeah, basically, because this is a Diablo Cody scripted film, the ironic register of the screenplay is suffocating. It loops around from being, like, intentionally sarcastic to being just maddeningly unfunny in a matter of seconds. Like the infamous, I smell Thai food, have you two been fucking joke.
Or the moveon.org.
Yeah.
Ugh. It's just that the dialogue is so... This sort of weird, non-existent teen slang is all over the film. You know, like Biffs for BFF.
Yeah, right.
Or, lime green jello for someone who's severely jealous.
Or you need a mani bed, you should find a Chinese chick to buff your situation.
Yeah. And I can understand where it's coming from, because... Like a lot of other films, like, say, Clueless, which does it well, or, say, SFW, which doesn't, it's clearly motivated by the Ghost of Heathers, where a lot of the slang was thoroughly invented, and it managed to become a part of the lexicon anyway.
What's the difference between this and Heathers, though? Heathers invents its slang.
Yes.
This is a film that it appropriates current slang to the point where it's not only using contemporary slang in an ironic way, it's like repurposing it in a
It's trying to take popular slang and then jump as a jumping off point to invent its own slang. We've all heard BFF, but no one says Biff.
Right.
Yeah. So, it's attempting to kind of create its own hermetic little Diablo Cody world, and it fails pretty spectacularly every turn.
Before we go any further, we should just lay out the basic plot of the film. Jennifer's Body is about a...
No, we shouldn't.
Just give me a moment.
Okay.
Jennifer's Body is about Chloe Moretz. No, what's...
No, it's Amanda Seyfried.
Yeah, sorry.
Chloe Moretz is a bit young for that.
Yeah, whatever. Amanda Seyfried, the chick from Red Riding Hood, stars as a girl that has had to put down her best friend, played by Megan Fox, who is possessed by an evil demon, and starts becoming a literally man-eating bitch.
She-bitch.
Basically.
And I would like to point out on that note that the framing device and the narration are both thoroughly totally unnecessary. It's just narrative cleverness, and it adds nothing to the film. Other than a sense of anticlimacticness at the final.
All it does in the film is it basically allows already insecure filmmakers to wrap up loose ends in such a way that it feels definitive and like you're getting that much more of a sense of resolution to a film that you don't really want a sense of resolution.
It's like, hey, remember when we talked about that bit earlier there? Yeah. Huh?
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, the main problem in this film, as I see it, is that, like, there's just too much a sense of confidence in what is fundamentally unfunny, ironic humor, to the point where, like, when it comes time for these characters to act sincere, it just sounds horrid, because they don't have the fundamental tools to be sincere, so it's like, sometimes, like with Sam Raimi, they mask their, like, incompetence with camp. They mask it with irony, basically.
No, and there's the clear Sam Raimi name check there. Is that my Evil Dead t-shirt?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right before a lesbian makeout scene,
yeah,
which is kind of an object lesson on how pandering and obnoxious the film is.
Right,
it's clearly aiming at the fanboy contingent.
It is, but
the general timbre of Jennifer's Body is like you know, we've all seen Juno, and you know how it started out at that sort of obnoxious register, like where the typical idea of it is the Rainn Wilson character at the beginning of that. You know, that's one doodle that can't be undid. And then slowly it evolves into an actual movie where, you know, where the defensive, ironic stances of the characters make sense.
Right.
Jennifer's Body is a film that got stuck at the Rainn Wilson character.
Right. Say what you want, but Jason Reitman's movies always have that ability to impress you with their square, corny sense of... you know, heteronormative niceness.
Okay, I'll
you know,
buy
they're
that.
Totally like they're. No matter how horrid Juno is, it's at least good at showing you. It's at least good at being sincere.
Yeah.
Jennifer's Body has no desire. Like, well, no, it doesn't. That's the thing. To say it has no desire to be sincere is
wrong. It wants to be sincere.
It wants to be sincere in parts, and that's what kills me. Like, where the part where they. Seyfried's character says about Adam Brody, who plays a lead singer of a band that winds up turning out to be a very manipulative group that takes advantage of, like, a town's tragedy, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
She compares Adam Brody to, quote, this petrified tree I once saw when I was a kid. And then we see her as a kid looking at the tree that she mentions.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which is which here, you know, like, the fact that we're actually looking at the tree that she's mentioning or the fact that she's literally talking about a petrified tree... unironically, just randomly dropping in there between lines like, you know, huge tragedy boner and big go all Benihana on my ass, you know, like...
Or how about the, you know, the, when we find out what actually happened to Jennifer on the night of the...
Right, the rape, yeah.
Yeah. It's
a murder.
It's a murder. But it's coded as a rape, and she thinks it's going to be a rape, but it turns out to be demonic sacrifice.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's horrible and violent, and she, the Megan Fox Jennifer character is clearly scared and begging for her life, and then the script has to keep undercutting that with, the fucking ironic bullshit from the band. Like the bit where right as they're about to kill her, they all start singing apropos of nothing, 8675309.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just like, fuck you.
And that's
if you're not going to take your horror seriously, why the fuck should we?
That's the thing. This movie, after a certain point, is trying to position itself as a post 9/11 film because it's suggesting that like after 9/11, all you can do to cope with tragedy is to be ironic and laugh it off.
Yeah. Well,
the problem with that is it succumbs to its like own love of that irony.
Yeah.
It likes it so much to the point where it doesn't see it as being problematic. The fact that these characters can't share their emotions without sounding like total fucktards. It, like, embraces the fact that, oh, the folly of youth is actually kind of fun to be around.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the problem with, like, the line you mentioned to me earlier that,
Yeah, sorrow was last week's emotion.
That is an absolutely, like, that's the turning point in the film, because, like...
That's the point when the film becomes thoroughly hopeless.
Yeah.
Not that it's not relatively hopeless anyway, because, I don't know why Karen Kusama is still in Hollywood. I mean, she's proven twice now with major budget projects that she clearly has no clue what she's doing. Mm. But, you know, so it's kind of technically hopeless, and the irony doesn't help the film at all. But at the same time, the second time through it, I can kind of see how you know, there's a name check to 9/11. Granted, it's in the form of a 9/11 memorial shot, which itself is poisonously obnoxious.
There's also the
but
way
the point is the point is that they under that the specter of it is there, and then there's the central tragedy, which is reminiscent of the Great White Club fire,
right?
That killed a bunch of people.
Like
then there's the passing line where someone in the background mentions their father being part of Operation Enduring Freedom.
That and the fact that J.K. Simmons' character, who's a teacher, says that we can't let that fire win.
Yes,
and Megan Fox says it already won.
Yeah, it's. There's clearly something being constructed here that is an attempt at a genre metaphor for survivor's guilt.
Yes.
But with that line, sorrow is last week's emotion, the film just fucking gives up on it. It's like, we're trying to construct something around this metaphor, and it's hard. Can't we just make a straight-ahead demon possession movie?
Well, I would give it more credit. I would say that basically with that line, it's basically saying that, like, any potential for these characters to, like, shake themselves out of the funk they're in, or just to at least admit to themselves that they're being, you know, like, histrionic and, like, just come to their senses, you know, after a certain point. You know, that should be, like, the point in the film where someone slaps them and they wake up.
Yeah.
But they don't. And the point is, it's, like, it's their way of saying that you can live a totally irony-laden existence and be okay with that. And, you know, that's fine in theory, but, you know, when you have lines like, do you buy all your murder weapons from Home Depot? God, you're such a bitch. I really question...
That's not even the worst line in that scene.
Give me
the line. Simon here is talking about the final confrontation between the demon-possessed Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried, mm-hmm. who is, at this point, an avenging angel, hell-bent on destroying the demon, mm-hmm. because it has eaten her boyfriend.
Right.
The worst part of that scene... is right after the struggle when Seyfried does take the box cutter and stabs it into the heart of Megan Fox. And what's Megan Fox's response? My tit! Fuck you!
Yeah, really.
It's just... It's like
bad.
It's like they couldn't decide on a tone, so they tried all of them. And everything undercuts everything else.
It's a tonal buffet.
Yeah, it's...
There's one scene in that film, though, that actually kind of almost made me want to see that film in a different light. And that's because that taps into the fact that, like you said, that they're trying out everything. But that line where Chip, Seyfried's boyfriend, he makes a reference to Phil Collins, and she doesn't know who Phil Collins is. And because she's a myopically self-important teenager armed with a little bit of knowledge. Or no, he is, at least. And he tries to tell her not to worry that he's seminal. That's what he says. He's seminal, but it doesn't matter. So that sort of sense of overweening entitlement was the one time I felt like Cody successfully made fun of her characters.
I kind of like the Chip character altogether, honestly. And I wish that the film had been more about him. I don't know. Or I would watch a film about him. in his character and trying to figure out why his girlfriend's suddenly gone bonkers in his eyes. But no, we have to get this sort of, you know, ironic sort of second wave feminist in a
post,
weird sort.
It's not even feminist. It's post feminist.
Yeah, almost. It's like trying to be feminist, but it doesn't want to be at the same time. I don't know. It's just a mess. And
what's your favorite bad line in that film?
Probably the very first line of the film.
What?
Hell is a teenage girl.
Ay, ay, ay.
That or Megan Fox's reaction to the 9/11 anniversary shot. Oh, Tower One isn't full enough.
Wow, I really didn't even remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
I like
that is an actual line that somebody that an Oscar-winning screenwriter wrote.
You're assuming being an Oscar winner means something.
I know, I'm aware. Or the point where Jennifer decides to name check Aquamarine.
Oh my god, yeah, I remember that. I don't remember the Tower One joke, but I remember the Aquamarine reference. My favorite worst line in that film though is where I think Chip's little sister calls him a penis cheese.
Yes, penis cheese. It's like Diablo saw E.T. when she was growing up and like retained that. But was like, oh, I gotta put that in my movie when I make it. And yeah, but no, just a piece of shit. An absolute piece of shit. And I have to imagine that the Midnight audience rejected that shit en masse. Because, I mean, a lot of the Midnight audiences for Toronto fall for some stupid shit. But the point is, most of the stuff they fall for is at least sincere in its genre aspirations.
Yes, they certainly do.
And I have to imagine if I showed up to watch a Devil Possession movie and got this bullshit instead, I would be pissed the fuck off.
Then again, you have to understand that, like, if you're buying a ticket for a Diablo Cody scripted film,
you kind of have to understand that it's going to be hipper than thou. Yeah. But
so what do you want to do next? Devil's Chair?
Let's move from an ironic horror film to one that thinks it's being serious.
The Devil's Chair?
Yes.
The Devil's Chair, okay.
Yes.
The Devil's Chair is directed by Adam Mason and co-scripted by him and Simon Boyce. These guys are favorites of the Twitch film crew, who I used to run with for a little while. They're great guys. I don't always see eye to eye with them, and this happens to be one of those times. Adam Mason is a filmmaker house painters are artists. they are bereft of, you know, the kind of... They're basically... Even if you look at them within the lens of, like, primitivist horror filmmakers, Adam Mason and Simon Boyce are both uniquely bereft of talent.
This is the first time I've experienced Adam Mason. I know you said you've seen a couple other films he's made, and
monotonous and dull. That's the word.
I do not look forward to any further interactions with Mr. Mason, because The Devil's Chair is... The Devil's Chair is a putrid shell game of a movie.
Yeah.
And it's a film that thinks
it's an unsuccessful shell game, too.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah, it's not
it
even...
It gives up on that.
It's not even clever at being clever.
The thing is, to be more concrete, this is a film that starts off looking like a pretty generic movie about a man played by... What's this guy's name?
I don't remember.
It's this guy who's the...
It's the guy who played the evil sheriff in the I Spit on Your Grave remake, if anybody saw that. And he also plays the Russian gangster in Limitless.
We're talking about Andrew Howard.
Thank you.
He looks like, if you were to just look at him based on looks, he looks like Jason Statham with Down syndrome. he is...
That's so horrible.
I'm sorry, but it's true. I'm telling it like it is. But Andrew Howard, who is a regular in Mason's films, and he's actually better in Mason's Blood River, which is actually a shitty movie, but, you know, at least has a modicum of integrity to it in its own sleazy way. Whereas The Devil's Chair, Andrew Howard plays a guy that is worried about the fact that he killed his wife, and he's being forced by a psychiatrist to visit the site of the murder, which is an abandoned insane asylum.
I wouldn't argue that The Devil's Chair doesn't have integrity either. It's just integrity in the service of a A, well-worn, and B, pathetically rendered idea.
Well, I think that's what it's toying around with. The fact is, like, it looks like a mindlessly generic film from the start, although it tries to make it seem like, that's the thing, you were unnerved while we were watching it by the fact that Howard's character is constantly narrating the film. Lots of voiceover narration. Oh. The fact that he's, like, reminding you that this is, like, he's taking you out of the drama by, like, talking to you and, like, talking about how, like, let's rewind a bit, and then you actually see footage being rewound.
Yeah, and there were points where when he's narrating, like, the image will stop. You're watching a DVD and it's being paused so that you can turn and your friend can say something to you.
It's like if the Saw guys tried to do Brecht, basically. Just to try to imagine that.
Yeah.
It's very stupid in that way. Another analogy that we had is that it's like a Michael Haneke film. If the filmmaker didn't know anything about Michael Haneke and instead been only raised on Guy Ritchie films.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is that, like, so the first half of this film, you have these characters, all of who are pretty petty, pseudo-intellectual characters, because...
Well, it's clearly slasher template stuff.
It's not just slasher template stuff, though.
But I'm just saying, your first 45 minutes is set it up, next 45 is knock it down.
No, but you don't understand. The fact is, like, even within slasher template stuff, you don't have the anti-intellectual streak that you get in Mason's films. Mason is...
Not as thick, no, but...
That's the thing. Mason is constantly wary and skeptical of anyone that thinks that they can get more experience out of learning. And, you know, anything that's not lived experience, which is why he basically champions Howard's character in the end. Howard's character is, like, the evil bad man, but he's also considered to be, like, better than the characters because at least he has a bit of self-knowledge. He has experience under his belt, and he's not basing everything he's saying on, you know, nonsense that he read or stuff that he's just, you know, pulling out of his butt, like, yeah. These characters.
If I were to be more charitable towards this film, or if it were better made, I could debate that. I'm not in terms of Mason siding with the Johnson character.
Howard.
Howard, yeah. I don't know where we got Johnson from.
Johnson!
Howard Johnson? But yeah, siding with the Howard character, in terms of, I think the intent wasn't necessarily to celebrate the mindset of this psychotic. It was just, you know, I guess in a way, I'm sort of agreeing with you, but not in that it's clearly meant as all the book learning these doctors did couldn't have prepared them for this.
Right, but it's beyond that, though, like, because once the film turns into, like, a cheap knockoff of Hellraiser 2, except meta, because, like, the thing is, like, these characters go into, like, another dimension where, like, the chair that Howard's character killed his wife in...
It's a little medieval torture chair that if you stick your finger in a hole, it pricks your finger, and the blood feeds the chair, and then it turns into this weird little mechanical thing that binds your arms and legs and head...
Right, pure Clive Barker-like stuff.
Absolutely, basically. Absolutely. And then it sucks you in another dimension where a demon with a cow skull wearing a trash bag eats you.
And he's got tentacles, damn it.
And he's got hentai tentacles.
Gonna rape you. Anyway, so yeah, this weird cow skull tentacle monster in the extra dimension of Hellraiser 2 is basically just like...
Rachel, where are you?
Enough. The Mason character is like... Mason is basically, you and boys are using this as a means of showing that, like, that's the monster that these characters are expecting. At the same time, the monster that they're not expecting is Nick West, because they all assume from the outset that he is, on some level, if not innocent, not the boogeyman that they're expecting.
Harmlessly crazy.
Exactly. Like, he's been rehabilitated to the point where he's not a threat anymore. And the fact of the matter is, the film really turns on its head and starts recriminating the audience actively through...
Literally, in the narration. Oh, you thought you were gonna see some B-movie? Just some torture porn gore whore bullshit?
Yeah, they actually say, like, that's almost like a verbatim line.
Literally, the narration turns around and starts admonishing the audience.
But when that happens...
For showing up to watch a shitty B-movie. But the thing is that Mason had been making a shitty B-movie for an hour and 10 minutes before he suddenly decided, oh, I don't want to do this anymore.
Worst of all,
that mission was annoying.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Colleen Steve Carlson's lovely wife.
Yes.
But yeah, the point is that hideous change in the film is motivated by the fact that boys and Mason are trying to get you to see this as the point where Howard's character is understanding who he really is. You know, the fact is that he can at least, he's mature enough to realize, I'm a disgusting human being, and now I'm going to destroy everyone that's a phony and a fake, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And at least on that level, I'm honest with myself.
Yeah.
And that's why he's, on some level, not on some level, on a very overt level, he is siding with Howard's character.
Like I said, if the film were better made, I'd debate you on that. But you know what? I kind of think you're right, so.
And that's the thing. Like, I say that because Howard plays that character in the two other films of Mason's that I've seen, in Blood River and in what I've seen of Pig. I had to turn Pig off because I was... they actually only had it online for free as part of, like, some weird gimmick where you could watch it until, like, a certain hour, and I was cut off.
Hmm.
And I was kind of glad I was cut off because
it was really fucking
shitty.
Yeah.
But, yeah, both times Howard in Mason's films have played this, like, angel of death type character that has, like, exposed the sins of the main characters, the yuppie straight characters, and made them feel like they're, you know, more worthless than a character that is, you know, like, playing up how disgusting he is.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the most...
I'm a psychotic killer, but at least I'm honest!
Exactly. At least I admit it. You know?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, about as mature as a Slipknot lyric. You know, it's worthless. It yeah. is absolutely worthless.
It's a pointlessly nihilistic stance.
It is, and it provides nothing. Like, even like Blood River, which is like uses a lot of Christian iconography, is at least a little more interesting in its nihilism because the way that it like it tries to make it seem as if like hickishness and Christian faith and the way that it's been perverted is at least more. Honest than the way that agnostics and atheists use, which is it's bullshit, but it's still at least a provocative stance.
Yeah.
This film is just trying to say fuck you to the Midnight Madness audience.
Basically, yeah.
And it's, so I'm glad at least that Midnight Madness audiences were like, well, fuck you too, and walked out.
Yeah. And there are kind of two. It's a total Haneke Gambit type thing, and there's two ways you can pull that. You can do funny games where you excoriate the audience for liking violence while denying them that violence. I mean, funny games has a lot of, you know, has a lot of death in it, but most of the violence takes place off screen. Mm-hmm. Or you can do what I think Eli Roth is doing in Hostel Part 2. Or like what you were saying about Tom Six and The Human Centipede 2, which you just saw.
Oh,
give
yeah.
us so much violence that we don't want it anymore.
Basically. Yeah,
but Mason doesn't do either thing. He suddenly decides, oh, you people watching this, you're fucking terrible. And then he just proceeds to a standard psycho killer massacre.
Right.
It's like this, you know.
It takes no balls to do what Adams does, basically.
The key line here is, I think, during the voluminous narration, during the first rug pull, where the in-universe psychiatrists are shown to be evil, and they want people to go through the extra dimensional portal to feed right. the demon. Like, it's, they're evil, all of a sudden. And then, you know, the narration pipes up and says, never saw that coming, did you? And my reaction is, actually, yeah, I did. I've seen enough of these genre films that I kind of know how they work.
Right.
And I'm really insulted that you assume I'm as stupid as you are.
We're watching basically this film in a post-Wes Craven universe. The whole reversing the white hat, black hat binary is pretty old hat.
Yeah.
Ha 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 by now.
You're not as clever as you think you are. You're not clever at all. You're just a fucking asshat.
And just very unpleasant in general for its own sake.
Yeah, it's being nasty for nastiness' sake. And it's kind of a meretricious work, and I say fuck it.
Speaking of nasty for nastiness' sake, I think that's a good transition into the next film, which
so that we just, you know, don't get stuck on Midnight Madness titles.
Because
bad films happen outside of that, too.
It's not just genre films, folks. But yeah, the next one I want to talk about is Lucas Moodysson's A Hole in My Heart.
Which, incidentally, I am going to have to disagree with you about being nastiness for nastiness' sake. But.
Well, that's the thing. The whole aesthetic of this film is confrontational, I think, for the sake of making the argument that, like, as one character very nakedly puts it, everyone is basically unwhole. Everyone has two halves of themselves, and when they connect with another human being, that's their way of trying to be a whole person again.
Yeah, well, it's the same, it's like, did you see Hedwig and the Angry Inch?
I did not.
Okay, well, there's a whole number in that called The Origin of Love that advances the same thing.
I think Mitchell does it better.
I think it's. I would disagree. I don't like Hedwig at all, but.
Anyway. I'm sure he does it better.
I think it's an old Greek philosophy.
The fact of the matter is, though, that like Lumutison's aesthetic for this film, which is like channel surfing, where he's constantly flicking indiscriminately between certain aggressive scenes and like showing you like a labial
reconstructive surgery,
the like weird shots of like an open heart wound with someone like putting like a weird tubing next to it. Just like these really weird scenes of like sexually explicit porno scenes. Like a fake rubber vagina and
with army men being pushed into it.
Yeah, and the way that he flicks between that and like with like accompanied by sound effects, it's like this is justified by like that idea that he's trying to connect with the viewer, or at least he's trying to show his frustration with his inability to connect with the viewer by having these like really aggressive jump cuts and having these just constant like elisions with footage of like stuff that's designed to frustrate and jar you.
Well, yes.
He's poking you with a stick infrequently. Because
not infrequently.
Because he can't. Not infrequently.
Through the entire film.
Exactly. And he's doing it for the sake of saying, I can't be close to you! And that's fucking annoying. That's fucking annoying because it's a stance that assumes that, well, I can't do it, therefore it can't be done. It's like a Lars von Trier.
No, but I don't think he's saying it can't be done. I think it's a very confrontational work.
No, it is. No, the fact is, because the character, the voice of reason in this film is a myopic teenager who's constantly telling us stuff that we just have to accept at face value. Like the idea that in the beginning, man had were two people combined into one. We just accept that. That is a truth that is like fundamental to the meaning of this film.
You're missing the little glimmers of hope that happen in the film. Like
show me some, man.
Well, like the first time he talks to the blonde porn star, he tells her about the beings, the little fishes that live at the bottom of the ocean around the volcanic canyons at the bottom of the ocean where science says nothing should live there, but they do, and they exist and they thrive.
Mm. Okay.
And they've never had light thrown on them. So they don't have eyes, and they probably can't survive in the light. And that leads into her asking, well, what happened when the subs, you know, found them and with their flashlights and stuff? And he's like, well, they probably died.
Well, the fact of the matter is...
The fact is
that he's bringing up this glimmer of hope in such a hammer-on-head kind of way...
Well, the whole film
is... It's a function of his frustration, though.
Yes.
It's a function of the fact that... you know, the discourse is on a necessarily shallow level because Moodison doesn't want to try to go beyond that. Like, he has, like, the characters talk about the indoctrination of, like, gender roles through the use of, like, Barbie dolls and through porno. All this stuff that is, like, obvious.
Well, I just think
It's pseudo-intellectual stuff that plays out like a lo-fi Matthew Barney. I'm sorry.
I think it's a violently angry film.
Yeah.
And when you're angry, you're not talking subtleties. You're making your point in the bluntest manner possible.
You're assuming then that what I'm looking at is necessarily viscerally attractive, and it's not.
Well, I think it is, personally. I like it. Yourself. I like the craft with which it was made. I think it's attractively confrontational. I like the soundtrack. I just think it's a well-made film, honestly.
And to counter your use of the glimmers of hope, what about the bit where he says, the porn star comes back and says, it was so boring out there, it was so ugly, people are so ugly. That's not an authorial statement.
Well, yeah, but the point is you can still find peace in the world. Look at the last 5-10 minutes of the film.
I did. What are you talking about?
Well, where they're outside in the laundry room and they're just playing. They're just having fun. They've managed to find a moment of connection.
Their moment of fun is they're stuffing themselves into a laundromat machine.
It's something. I'm just saying, the way it's shot and the way it's set up, that's how it's intended.
I'm not sure about that, but okay.
But I think you're wrong, so meh.
All right.
But no, I think I personally think it's a very interesting film in how it.
I think it could have been an interesting film if it actually had a thought in its head that was actually original beyond, I'm angry, throwing scat at wall.
I think it does, and I don't think you're giving it enough credit, so, meh.
You know what? Let's talk about Shadow Boxers.
Because Shadow Boxer is incredible.
I don't agree.
It is incredible.
No.
But no, the whole... Yeah, well, no. I've got more to say about all my heart, but you don't seem to want to talk about it.
I want to kill them.
It's about the unseeable, and you know.
Go ahead. Like so let's talk.
No,
about
but you don't want to. You don't want to.
I don't want to talk about Wall in My Heart. You're right. But
you're right.
If you want to talk about it, I'll listen to your ideas. Let's go.
No, that's no problem. Let's move on.
Fine. So Shadow Boxer.
Yes, Shadow Boxer.
I'll let you tell me why Shadow Boxer is so great.
Because it's bonkers as fuck. It's like. I think we were describing it as it's like someone took the emotional beats of the emotional heightenness of a Douglas Sirk film, combined it with the color palette of Seijun Suzuki, and gave it the moral aesthetics of a Gordon Parks film, and then processed all that through a Lifetime made for television film.
The problem with that is all I see is the Lifetime film that went off the deep end.
And I don't see that as a bad thing. I wish all Lifetime films would go off the deep end.
I would watch
a lot more Lifetime if they did.
Wait, that's the thing. If you put a gun to my head and said, watch Lifetime film or Shadow Boxer, you're damn right I'm going to choose Shadow Boxer. But the point is, in any other given situation, I don't think we should be lauding a filmmaker like Lee Daniels for making a movie that is nothing more than like a really straight-faced but batshit crazy melodrama.
I don't think... You're misunderstanding me. I don't think it's a good film. I think it's pretty much terrible in every aspect. It is a film where a lot of decisions needed to be made, given the timbre of the screenplay. Mm-hmm. A lot of decisions needed to be made. Every one of them was catastrophic.
Let's talk about some of these decisions, like where Stephen Dorff sodomizes a man with broken pool cue.
Yes. Or the fact that the two central characters, Helen Mirren and Cuba Gooding Jr., are hired assassins
and
who are lovers.
The boat crews.
And Mirren is also Gooding's foster mother.
Yeah.
And she's dying of cancer.
And she's dying.
Let's up the fucking ante.
Or how about when randomly we were forced to watch... Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Monique having sex.
Yes! And Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a disreputable doctor for hire who supplies Monique with crack.
Oh, yeah. No.
It's terribleness and badness and wrongness at every turn, and what makes it amazing is that it takes itself so seriously. The material is fundamentally ludicrous.
It is.
You could not read this script with a straight face.
That's the thing. This seems like the kind of thing that, like, the story seems ripped, like, you ever go through, like, around 34th Street or Times Square, there are all these, books that are like these cheap erotica novels written from like the point of view of like frustrated black housewives that have like very sexy buff shirtless black men taking them away, and they're embedded in the film. There is that idea that there is nothing sexier than a topless Cuba Gooding Jr. because he is pure black
no,
sex.
You missed it. There is one thing sexier than a topless Cuba Gooding Jr.
What is that?
That is a bottomless Cuba Gooding Jr.
Right. There's
because apparently Cuba Gooding Jr. has an ass that can move worlds, change people's sexual orientation. Yeah.
Regardless of race, creed, or color.
Help world peace, cure cancer, or at least put cancer patients out of their misery in probably the single most ludicrous scene in the film.
The masturbation scene, yes.
No. I mean the second sex scene between him and Helen Mirren.
Oh, I was thinking about the masturbation scene.
The masturbation scene is pretty goddamn ludicrous, too.
The masturbation scene is amazing because they're... What's the actress's name?
Vanessa Ferlito?
Her. She is masturbating... while fantasizing about Cuba Gooding Jr. showering. And it's just basically Cuba Gooding Jr. like making these weird shadow boxing type motions while in the shower in slow motion.
Is that
and
what
he's like,
was doing?
Yeah. And, he's,
and then he looks back at her over his shoulder, giving her the blue steel look.
Yeah. And he's just like, are you ready for this? Like, he's got this aura about him. He's like, yeah, I know. I'm naked. Don't you love it? I am a sex god. And like, and she's just like, she's going at it. And it, like, you could like, in any other setting, I could totally see Lee Daniels, if he didn't feel like he wanted to try to get an R rating, going for it, just showing this woman like full frontal, going
yeah,
for
just,
it.
With full on squirt on the camera lens and everything.
But that brings us back to my problem. If you're going to make a disreputable movie, or at least a movie that is this crazy sincere about like the potential good that can come from being disreputable, just make a fucking Gaspar Noé movie. At least have the balls to make a suggestion that breaking taboos is good for you in a fucking openly disreputable way.
But see, that's the thing. He Daniels doesn't want to be disreputable.
That's what I hate about him!
But you have to remember, he's a producer first. He produced The Woodsman and Monsters Ball and a couple other indie, like, you know, like very prestigious indie films. And I guess the idea was that for his first time at bat in the director's chair, he'd try and bring that sort of prestigious, authoritative gravity to the most retarded project he could find.
Right, and it shows.
And I personally think that the division between the intent of the material and the execution is
immense. Yeah,
I love it. I just, the space between is just, it's such a beautiful place to be.
Well, the thing is about this movie that I find interesting, at least, or symptomatic of what I don't like more accurately, is the way that both this and Precious, the second and hopefully last Lee Daniels film, although that's not going to happen.
No, of course not. And trivia note, Monique is in this, and her character is named Precious.
Oh my god. Foreshadowing. Anyway, foreshadow boxing.
You know, oh, boo!
I had to get my licks in. The fact is that, like, so in both Precious and Shadowboxer, there's that image of the father figure taking off his belt and whipping the child protagonist, in this case Cuba Gooding Jr.
And there's also surrogate parents all over the place.
And this just speaks to the fact that, like, the idea is here that we're going to talk about how abuse informs but doesn't necessarily become the end-all and be-all of what a character's personality is like. You know, the Cuba Gooding Jr. character's emotional arc is breaking away from the cycle of violence, yada, yada, yada.
You're assuming he even has a character arc. Or an emotional arc, anyway. Not played by Cuba, he doesn't.
Yeah, he does. It's shit.
Stone face. Beginning of film, stone face. End of film, stone face.
I'm not talking about how he acts in the film. I'm talking about the way...
Seriously, Cuba in this film tries to you know, achieve a sort of serious actor pose, and he just looks like he's in the film at gunpoint.
He really does.
He wants to be somewhere else. You can just look at him and go,
I want to be somewhere else.
It's like right after every take, he went off screen, went to the computer, looked himself up on the Internet Movie Database, and just looked through his roll of credits and started weeping. Like, really? Boat trip? What was I thinking?
Boat trip, right. I said boat cruise.
Not boat cruise, boat trip. But, yeah, no, I just... But the film is just so self-serious, and everything else in the film is doing everything it can to tear through that veil of serious art film. I mean, fucking Macy Gray's performance alone. She's just wandering around the film, dropping motherfucker into every third line, talking about, you know, getting drunk and talking about cutting off men's dicks. This is not a performance that shows up in a serious movie. But Shadowboxer wants to be a serious movie. Capital S, capital M.
Yeah, that might be appropriate. Actually, SM.
And how can you hate a film where Helen Mirren gets her groove on to Nas?
Yeah, there's that scene where she's bumping and grinding with Cuba Gooding as he's, like, putting on, like, a striptease for her, and she just, like, backs that ass up into her. Craig Lindsay, if you're listening, this is the film for you if you haven't already seen it.
Oh, I'm sure he's seen it several dozen times.
Sorry, Craig. But, yeah, it's... this movie.
I kind of think you could start a religion around this movie. I really do.
Come on. I think it's a cult.
It's got a random zebra in it.
There is a random zebra in it.
And I don't know what happened to the... I swear to God, when I first saw this film...
What happened to that zebra?
When I first saw this film, you could totally see Stephen Dorff's cock in that one scene. Where he jumps out and goes, what did I tell you about talking while I was fucking? And then randomly shoots two guys.
I think you just like Stephen Dorff a little
bit. I love Stephen Dorff's cock, I gotta say.
Anyway... Let's.
So yeah. So I guess the moral of the story is even major festivals like Toronto have to fill slots sometimes, and sometimes they fill those slots with shit that doesn't belong there.
So, like any of the four films we just mentioned.
I could make a case for A Hole in My Heart actually belonging at a major
film. No.
Yep. But then again, you also haven't seen any of Moodyson's other films aside from Container, which doesn't fucking count.
It so. Totally counts.
It doesn't count.
My balls. How about that? So, Netflix rabbit.
It'd be like trying to figure out what Herzog's doing after having only seen Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
Netflix rabbit.
You can't argue with Netflix. Me. I'm right.
No. No, I can totally see what he's doing in that film alone, and I can totally judge it on its own terms, and I totally just did.
Nope.
Balls.
No!
Friend, because you didn't have a sufficient answer to any of the accusations I had.
Balls.
Are you going to touch your gut while we're doing this?
Yes.
Listener, this is very distracting right now. Steve is touching the folds of fat that are his stomach, and he's all like, blah, 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 blah.
He does that a lot, actually.
Balls to you.
No, that's not your balls. That is your gut.
I can make it my balls.
Okay, fuck you. Netflix crap. The Netflix grab bag feature, if you are a first-time listener, is an option that we have every time where we take a couple of titles randomly from either Steve's queue or my queue. This month it was my queue. The instant queue, to be exact. And because, you know, there's always all this stuff in your queue that you're never going to get around to, but you add in there anyway. And you've been there for years, and this is just a good excuse for us to pick a couple titles out and save them from obscurity.
Yeah.
So we gave, and the hook of this feature, the Netflix grab bag, is that we let you, the listener, choose what film we listen to. We let you vote. And this month, you voted overwhelmingly for Loud, Quiet, Loud, a film about the Pixies. Colleen's wife finds that very funny. No, I mean, Steve's wife, Colleen, finds that very funny.
Colleen's wife? Really? Colleen, you have a wife?
Yeah.
Hopefully. How come we haven't been introduced?
This is getting hot and steamy.
Oh, I'm so disappointed right now.
Sorry.
Anyway, so Loud, Quiet, Loud.
Yes.
Which is, I found to be a very compelling concert documentary for the most part.
I thought it was pretty interesting.
Oh, I thought you said the movie was about Pixies.
Yeah,
no,
the Pixies.
The Pixies, the band.
Oh,
baby.
Okay.
Colleen apparently doesn't know who the Pixies are.
I don't.
This is you're going to have to fix this, Steve.
Yeah, it's not her taste.
Okay. Anyway, so, I admit, first of all, disclaimer, we are probably the choir that this film is preaching to.
Well, you are. I have to go on and admit, despite growing up pretty much in that era, that I still have a basic unfamiliarity with a lot of Pixies stuff.
I am the choir.
I own Bossa Nova, and I own Doolittle, and at this point, I could still only identify maybe Monkey Gone to Heaven,
I am
and
the Walrus.
Debaser, and Valoria, and that's about it. So, and Where Is My Mind, because it was in Fight Club.
Right.
Oh, okay, but,
fucking poser. Anyway, but, so the point
I've always meant to get into them, and I just never did.
But
so.
The fact is, this documentary is very good, because it encapsulates a lot in the, it's very, like, the way that it uses footage both on stage and off to enhance the basic understanding of where the Pixies are right now. This was during the 2004 reunion tour, and you know, this was I don't know how many years.
Self-awarely called Pixies Sellout.
Yeah.
Because,
well, not self-awarely, tongue-in-cheekly. Come on.
I just think there was a measure of a certain measure of self-awareness in it. Was definitely tongue-in-cheek, yes. But at the same time, I think you know, at least two of the band members are on record as having done it because they definitely needed the money.
Yeah, but the fact is, when you look at Frank Black Francis and you look at Kim Deal performing on that reunion tour, I dare you to tell them that they're doing it for the money.
Oh no!
They change up the tempo of those songs.
I'm not saying it
specifically to be to show that they have changed and to do something with those.
I'm not saying the performances sound like sellouts. I'm just saying that the motivation for the tour was at least a little sellout-ish.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But that's besides the point.
Given the acrimonious way they split up.
Yeah, which they even use.
They touch on in the film where Frank Black, then Black Francis, broke up the band without actually telling any of the other members of the band.
Right. This is what I like. The fact is that this is very respectful documentary filmmaking, but at the same time, it's not willing to pull back like an Errol Morris type filmmaker is, and just like let the and not pursue its subject after a certain point. These filmmakers, the directors of the film, basically pursue the Pixies, individual members, and make sure that they get, like, in little micro scenes, because, like, it's a very chopped up and heavily edited film.
Very much so.
It gets to the heart of drama within certain films. Like, you get the idea that they had spools and spools of film, and that they just basically chose the best of what they had. And they have a very keen eye. So normally I'd be reluctant to embrace any filmmaker that says, well, we're just going to give you the best of our footage and not give you, like, the surrounding context of what you're seeing. But I think they do it, and I think that reflects, as in the title, Loud, Quiet, Loud, like, the idea that, like, there's a lot of tempestuous emotions, and they're, like, they're kind of hashed out with the band on stage, off stage, a little bit of both.
I was going to say, I think most of the hashing out is done within the music.
Exactly.
Because as I think Kelly Deal puts it, you guys are the worst four communicators ever.
Right.
Ever! So there's all this unspoken hostility and acrimony and just, you know, a lot of not getting along. It's basically the arc of the film is legendary band reunites only to realize why they broke up in the first place.
And yet, at the same time, the fact that, like, the coda of that film is that they went on to more tour dates after that final tour in New York.
But they still haven't gotten into the studio to release an album.
Yeah.
Even though, on the tour that we're shown, both Kim Deal and Frank Black are openly writing new material.
Right.
For each other's own solo projects. Mm. It's like, they're on the road. They're cool being on the road.
Their respective solo projects. They're not swapping them. Like, I wrote the song for you, Frank!
Yes, that's what I meant. But,
yeah.
You know, they're okay with being on the road, even though, you know, Kim Deal gets her own trailer to travel around in, which is understandable because she's a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. And at one point in the film, the drummer, David, what's his last name?
I forget. Let me look that up. I just know him as Dave.
Yeah, but he...
Dave the drummer.
He has a family tragedy in which his father dies.
David Lovering,
thank you. And he sort of falls into a cycle of alcohol and drugs. But, you know, the point is, yes, they're traveling around as a touring band. They're okay with spending that much time with each other. But they don't want to be cooped up in the studio with each other. Because that's going to create a pressure cooker situation.
The one, at the same time, to play it devil's advocate, I find that, like, in theory at least, you should be willing to give, in a concert doc especially, that contextualizing, boring footage surrounding the, like, stuff that where stuff is actually happening on stage and you actually see, like, a spark of drama, like, whether it's in, like, a glance between Kim Deal and Black Francis, mm-hmm. or just, like, the way that he turns the guitar, like, just little moments like that, you should have, like, a certain context because, you know, the film's called Loud, Quiet, Loud. There's a quiet in there, and you have to have that interregnum period. And admittedly, the quiet period in this film is the offstage stuff.
Yes.
It is absolutely a concert documentary first and foremost.
Yes.
And that footage is beautiful.
Yes, it's terrific. I especially like the one sequence where the European tour, they condense... They take one song, three performances of one song, and cut it so it's condensed into one song, and it's done seamlessly.
Mm. Was that Caribou?
I think it was Caribou. Yes.
Yeah.
You're right. That wasn't the European tour. That was Canada.
Yeah.
You're right. Yes. But yeah, Caribou.
I just love the fact that, like, they have such a sense of humor that it's like, what are they doing in Canada?
Caribou, of course.
Yeah, that's great.
But no, the point I was originally going to loop around to was the. The title's also a reference to the dynamics of a Pixies song. You know, it's they're very much into the quiet, loud, you know. And the point is, when they're off stage, they're all quiet all the time, and they don't necessarily confront each other over the things they're feeling. So the songs become these cathartic releases where they can just, you know, let out all that energy and just, you know, it's like I was kind of resisting the film for a bit, but just because it seemed kind of pro forma concert doc stuff. But, you know, it kind of slowly got into it when I kind of realized that it was about just about the tensions between the band and how they were all internalized all the time. You know, there wasn't going to be any big showy throwing furniture at each other scene. It was just, you know, it's like everyone knows the tension is there, and everyone is keeping it in.
That's why I think this is very nervy filmmaking. I especially like the scene where
the intervention scene is crucial.
Well, the Frank scene where he's with his wife and they're going with the kids through the cornfield, and like,
yes,
you can see that the wife is bristling at the idea that there's like a camera with them during family time, and she's like, "Honey, what are we doing?" And he's like, "We're following the children through a cornfield."
No. Here's the thing. He doesn't. It's a beautiful moment of passive aggression. He doesn't say we're following the kids. We're following your kids.
He says that? Okay.
He says your kids. He makes a point to specify that they are not his children.
I didn't catch that. Wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. Like, it's, they make a point of showing that, like, this guy is still living with a lot of tension, and they express it also in a great, that other great scene where he's like listening to that self-help tape, and
yes,
he's just like, "I'm cute,
yeah,
I'm worth it,
yes,
I'm happy."
It's a bit on the nose, but at the same time, it makes its point, and then it moves on, and we don't return to that. You know, I was kind of because that happens, I think, pretty early on in the film. I was afraid that was going to be something they were going to harp on, but no, it's bang, it's done. Okay, we established that. Now we're going to move on.
And it's like the song cues. The use of the song cues is very note on the nose, like the fact that they open and close with "Hey," which, if you're a Pixies fan, you know, like, the lyrics. And even if you're not a Pixie fan, you probably should know the lyrics of "Hey."
Yeah.
But, like, the fact is, like, to open and close with that song...
Well, then they don't really close with that song. The last song in the film, playing over the credits.
Yeah,
they do close with "Monkey Gone to Heaven."
Which I love, because the fact is, like, it's not just the concert documentary about what the music means to these guys. It's about, like, the effect. And this is, I guess, where the film is a little weak, where it talks about, like, how fans process it and how they've internalized the way that this music speaks to them.
Right.
And, like, you get people like that girl and her band who wind up playing this really shitty cover of "Monkey Gone to Heaven."
I think it's okay, except for the singing. You can't.
The singing is awful.
Yeah. I mean, the instrumentation is.
It's pure garage band.
Hey,
it's a pure garage band.
They're teenagers, you know. That's when you do that sort of shit.
This lovely, but
and
I don't think that makes it good.
Hey, let them take influence from the Pixies, then, you know, you have fucking Nickelback, for instance.
Okay, but still, like, hey, that was a great way to end the scene too. But like, or the film, but the fact, like, remains that, like, the there's that phrase again. The emotional arc of the film is opened and closed with "Hey," and even the uses of songs like "Vamos" and just, like, showing the band noodling on stage, riffing, and, you know, it's very on the nose, but, like, I'm gonna be honest, I can't help but, like, sing along with every fucking song.
I should probably ask you this thing. I kind of missed the import of it, but I forget which song it was, but it was the really, really noisy one where all Frank does is yell into the microphone about...
Something against you.
Yeah.
I love that song.
And then, but then the drum, like, they all stop and the drums keep going.
Yeah.
And
that's not in the song at all.
Yeah. Well, I was just wondering what was the problem there? Like,
I don't know. I think there was, like, some kind of weird technical glitch, or, like, Frank was just, like, sick of doing the song.
Well, it started out as being intended to be a glitch, but it ended up being symptomatic of the drummer's drug problem.
Right.
Because I think that leads into the intervention scene.
Right.
Which is, like, the most low-key intervention ever. They all just kind of sit around and go, you know, maybe you shouldn't be doing what you're doing right now. I mean, I understand you're under a lot of stress, you know, with your dad dying and stuff, but it's probably not good for you. And, you know, Kelly here, she's, you know, recovering and probably not good for being around this. So, you know.
Kelly or Kim?
Kim, sorry. Yeah, not Kelly.
Kelly is Kim's sister.
Kelly's Kim's twin sister who played with her in
the Breeders.
Yeah. But, no, and it leads to that great moment where Frank goes, maybe you should see a psychiatrist, one who knows about alcohol and drugs, and then David just gets this look on his face, like it's like he starts to smile, and then he just swallows it. Like, it's just this moment of, yeah, maybe you guys are right. Okay, maybe I'll go do that.
And then, like, you get that intertitle that says that he agreed to,
Yeah.
What did it say? He agreed to,
It agreed to abstain from alcohol and drugs for the remainder of the tour.
Yeah. And so, yeah, exactly. You don't really know that's what's going, or yeah. You don't really know definitively that that's what's going on until like the end of that scene where it's like, oh shit, okay.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what I just mean about all the drama being internalized. It's like, you know, just there's clearly issues still being worked out among the people in the band, but they don't make a show of it.
And that's the thing. Like, the beauty of it is these filmmakers understand exactly what they have on film. Yeah. They understand that the tension between these people are so palpable that, like, you can get away with telling a whole story just by showing, like, concert footage where everything is told in, like, the glimpses between characters and in the poses that these characters strike while they're performing.
Right.
And that's great. I think that's great documentary filmmaking because it's a narrative out of... It basically does very little to shape a narrative out of what's already essentially a very, you know...
Shapeless?
Well, not very shapeless, but what is already, like, a very dramatic event. The reunion tour.
Yeah.
And even if... I also like the fact that it's a very unassuming film. Like, it doesn't do very much to convince you of the importance of the Pixies. It starts off with the idea...
It gives you the basics and assumes you know the rest.
The fact that, like, they have that quote where Kurt Cobain is being interviewed in Rolling Stone. He said, I basically was just trying to rip off the Pixies with Nevermind. And, you know, that's... It's such a, like, you can't even take that at face value. But the fact is, he's right. They were influenced by the Pixies.
Pretty heavily. Yeah, them and the Melvins.
And the thing is, like, from there, you don't really need to know a lot about how important they were to the music world. You just need to know that they're important within the lives of the members of the band and within the lives of their fans.
Right.
Which is why I feel like whereas many concert docs, like, the reaction shots of the crowd being elated and singing along, those mean nothing in any other context. Within this context, those reaction shots mean so much.
Yeah.
So, I found it to be a very satisfying movie.
I was pretty keen on it. And I'm glad I saw it. And basically what it does is it makes me want to actually go and hear all the Pixie stuff I've missed.
You need to.
Which I should do anyway.
So good.
But I'm working through something else right now, which I'm actually too embarrassed to admit. So.
What?
No, I'm not admitting it.
On the air.
Here. No.
Do it.
Hell no.
Do it. Do
there
it.
Ain't nothing you can do to get me to say.
All right, fine. So. Look. The next, we'll just go on to what are the choice, our listeners' choices for next month's Netflix wrap-up.
Yes. You didn't write them down?
I didn't write them down because they're from your cue, buddy.
You had the computer. I didn't have anything next to me. Son of...
You had a computer. You were reading them off of a computer.
Son of a bitch.
One of them is that dark...
No, that wasn't one of the choices.
One of them is Island Fury for a third time.
No, we skipped that one.
We skipped that one. All right, we're going to pause here.
Pause it, and I'll figure out what they are.
So your four options this upcoming month for the Netflix grab bag are coming from Steve's queue, but this is his queue of physical discs, not his instant queue.
Not my instant queue.
So what are our options, Steve?
Well, the first option that we came up with was The Seduction of a Nerd.
Ooh.
Which is a Troma-released film. They didn't make it. They just own the rights to it. It was actually made, I believe, in 1967. And it stars Julie Newmar as the CEO of a toy company that is failing. And they need to come up with new toys.
Wow, this actually sounds pretty great.
Yeah, I believe Victor Buono is also in it. And
that's Julie Newmar.
I think it's meant to be some manner of sex comedy. So, that one. The second film we came up with was Unknown White Male. The 2005 documentary about the dude who woke up in the New York subways with no memory of who he was, and that's about it.
Oh my god.
You don't sound too enthused by that one.
Sorry. I'm not too enthused by that one because that was a movie that I actively like was like, that's a movie I will never see.
Well, this is the motivation
for you people to vote for that.
Hear that, everyone? Vote for that movie so Simon has to see it against his will.
I'll hurt you people. I'll hunt you down one ISP address at a time.
Get you Gadget next time?
The third film is the classic Curse of the Demon. With Dana Stevens.
Jack Torner.
Woo! I don't think anybody listening to this has to have me say anything about that film, so.
Fucking A right. I can't wait to see it. I haven't seen it. Vote for that.
Don't vote for that. Vote for Unknown White Male.
Yes.
Boring.
And the fourth and last film. Actually, no, you should all vote for this film. The fourth and last film is Werewolves on Wheels.
Fucker!
The only time that werewolves and biker movies ever met, they met in a bar one night and both got drunk and apparently went
the
home.
The fur was a flying.
And had sex. Oh, come on. No. The actual tagline for the film is, if you're hairy, you belong on a hog.
Yes.
So, yes. Werewolves on Wheels is pretty self-explanatory. So,
But otherwise, the topic for next month, the main topic, will be films by the creative powerhouse behind such films as Grizzly. That would be, what's his
and
name?
And Manitou.
Manitou. Woo,
that would be
boy.
the late William Girdler.
Yes, we're talking about the horror films of William Girdler as part of our Halloween-themed podcast. We are going to scare the shit out of you with terrible, terrible ideas, and we hope you're here to listen to it. If not, we'll just pretend you're here anyway, and what the fuck? We don't need you anyway. Who cares? You're probably going to vote for Unknown White Male, so we never wanted you anyway.
Disclaimer, we do need you.
We need you. I was just like, come back. We love you. Damn it.
Simon tends to lash out.
Papa, can you hear me?
he gets like this when he drinks.
I become Lucas Moodison. It gets really bad. I make really shitty art house films that Steve Carlson explicitly enjoys that I don't know what to yourself.
Oh, go see Show Me Love, you fucking.
I don't want to see Show Me Love. Better yet, you just show me love right here.
Go see Show Me Love and get back to me.
Okay, I think on that note, I will bid you adieu, and we hope you come back next time. Please come back.